It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking about weaving and looms and textiles and chemistry and physics and anywhere else we want to go. With me today is a guest, Gretchen Romy Tanzer. Did I get that right? Is it Romy Tanzer?
Yep, that's correct.
Great. Who's a weaver and owner of Tanzer Weaving Studios and Gallery. And welcome, Gretchen.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
I was in your gallery not too long ago, a couple times, and I'd like to start with something that I had never seen before, and I'd seen lots of weavers and lots of weaving, but there is something magical about what you do from two viewpoints. And it looks like there is a really good tie-in with some art and science kinds of ways of looking at that, and the way also math. And so the way you're laying these out. But the other one is that you do this fine art thing that I have not seen, where I've not seen it as a wall hanging in the way that you've created these specifically to be a work of art on the wall. I've seen people repurpose, you know, the things that they've done on the loom, but this is different. So how did you get started doing the fine arts part of weaving?
Oh, gosh. I think, you know, when I started weaving, I was always a kid who, you know, was a maker. And so the weaving for me was an avenue to create not functional things. I never really made functional things, although those do come into play because you're making fabric and, you know, inherently it wants to be a functional thing. But then I was always shooting towards the fine art end of it, sort of in the 70s when I started, and the 80s, fiber art and textile art was, was becoming a real thing. You know, you could big, huge sculptures like Magdalena Bakanowicz, a Polish artist, doing these enormous installations, and Claire Zeisler and you know, sort of the top of the line textile artists, and sort of that's where I delusions of grandeur, that's where my brain went. And all my teaching or my education was in fine arts with the textile leaning, so I was in a fiber department but making artwork, non-functional stuff.
I remember, I think it was at Indiana University where you
That was sort of the end of my education. I started at School for American Craftsmen in Rochester, New York, at RIT. They had quite an extensive craft department. And then I went to the Banff Center of Fine Arts in Canada. And that was definitely more art focused than function focused. And then on to Indiana University for an MFA in textile design, textile arts.
And Gretchen, that's really a wonderful route. Especially I know about RIT, the Rochester. They do all kinds of wonderful integrations between art and science, really.
They do. And it's so interesting because it's a technical school. It's not a university or college. The school has had a strong focus on photography and printing and but you're right. So more science-based than liberal arts. And that was fine for me. That was my direction anyway.
Yeah, and that sounds like you, from having talked to you, in terms of that you started kind of in the makerspace kind
of
yourself. But you have relatives and people that were in science. You told me a little bit.
Yeah,
so describe that journey too.
Yeah, well, my father was a geologist and geographer. My mother was an artist, and my brother is a biologist. Wow. So yeah, you know, both brother and father were professors in their field. And my mother was a functioning working artist, both in painting and textiles. She did quilting, and her quilts were not bed quilts. They were wall quilts. So sort of, again, the non-functional end of things. So yeah, I guess being in arts and sciences sort of was a natural blend. You know, we would go on field trips in the summer to rock outcrops for my dad. And then my mom was always drawing them. And so it just sort of, you know, was part of the whole combination of things. But the Indiana University thing is interesting, because both sets of my grandparents were IU grads. My parents were IU grads, my brother, my cousins. So it was just a natural fit to go there. And oh, by the way, they had a, you know, world-class art department.
I can see in your work the influence really of when you were talking about geology and stratigraphy, watching that, and colors too. You've got, I wouldn't call them earth tones, but they're more natural harmonizing colors. Is that a good description of it?
Well, the color is definitely something that I focus on. A lot of I have a strong Scandinavian influence in my artwork, because I did studied for a year in Finland at a textile school. So, you know, that's where some of that particular technique of tight flat weaving comes from. But the colors, I mean, I've been a high school art teacher for 29 years. I'm not doing that anymore. The color theory and how that all comes into play is, I always sort of approach color based on sort of the scientific end of it, rather than the emotional side. It's more, how do colors work? What do they do? How do they fit in an environment? So, yeah.
Yeah, and you can see that in the work. So you've got this kind of way, I think, of, you really have applied color theory to it in a way that I haven't seen people do that, particularly in textile art.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of weavers tend to go for, if they're doing functional things that will fit your environment, like blue dish towels or, you know, white tablecloth or whatever, that kind of thing. But for an art piece, those restrictions are off. You don't have to worry about fitting in with somebody's decor. At least you shouldn't have to worry about that. Sometimes the color, when I look at my wall of color, sometimes I'll just say, okay, now it's time to do something that is neutral tone. So I'll stick with sort of mid-range things, or you can neutralize a color by intermixing a dark and a light that neutralizes it. And one thing about weaving that's different than painting is, if you mix opposite colors in painting, it, like opposites like yellow and purple, you'll get kind of a mud color. But in weaving, you can always maintain the integrity of the fiber, because you can see it. You know, if you've got an evenly woven thing, you can see both the warp and the weft. You can always see, like if you're mixing red and green, you can see it. And it gives you kind of almost a moiré effect, depending on where you look at the fabric from the side or how it's lit. Yeah, you get some
Yeah, so it's a little bit, but goes beyond like pointillism in painting,
yep,
where you're putting the colors close together. However, the difference here in what you're trying to describe is when I back away from your work, it doesn't really blend together. It might be, like you said, a moire or a blurring, and it kind of fluctuates. Yeah. Where in painting, the further I get away, then it really just kind of does blend into a mixed color.
Yeah.
But yours, when I visited you the first time, I think one of the things that was really exciting for me was to see that you really work out these things on in a journal, kind of.
Oh yeah, gosh, and, yeah.
Can you describe that process? Because I think you have these journals. Go ahead and describe it.
Yeah, well, actually, right now I have right next to me. I don't know if this got a video feed.
Just on radio, but
I have my little sketchbook here. I recently, a new loom came into my weaving studio. Looms come and go from my weaving studio in Brewster. And so I always like to test drive a new loom after I fix it up and clean it. And so this one's it's a 56 inch wide 16 shaft loom, which is a little bigger than the one I do all my artwork on. So I'm really excited to try it out. And so I have to set up the pattern, the structural work, before I can start weaving. So all the warp, the color, and the block structure and the technical aspects have to be set before you start winding your warp, because otherwise you just sort of end up being technical aspects of it won't work out. Your fabric just won't stick together, won't weave together. Anyway, so I do have to really plan it out, and I do it with graph paper. I prefer 8x8 graph paper color pencils. Sometimes I use Illustrator or Photoshop if I need to do something that is flexible with layers for a client. But the color pencil, I work it out. I sort of assess what yarn colors I have to work with, because, you know, I have about as many colors as I can get in yarn, but it's not as many as you can get in colored pencils generally. So I work it out. If I want areas of the design to flatten out, I'll have light colors next to each other. If I want something to recede, I'll make them darker. If I want them to pop to the surface, I'll make them lighter, brighter, or more saturated. Technical aspects of the fabric need to be worked out as you do the design. Sometimes you'll do a drawing and think, oh, this looks great, but it can't work out. You need a more complex loom to do what you want. So you just have to pull back and work within the parameters of your equipment.
Yeah, so what if I can describe to the listener a little bit, the journal you had have taped pieces of fiber.
Yep.
yarn to it to show those colors, and then you also have your what your graph is, and I've also seen on some of your journal work also that you just sometimes have colors so you know what your palette is that you're working with.
Exactly. Or I'll taken a walk and I have to go back home to my sketchbook and just sketch out the colors that I saw that were appealing and for whatever reason, and then work with that.
That's amazing. So you have a lot of these sketchbooks around. Do you find yourself going back to them for inspiration?
I do. Yes. In fact, sometimes I'll do a very, do a drawing, do a design. It's called draft, down to sort of the nitty gritty of how many threads per inch and how long and how wide. And then I'll say, I don't need to do that, but I'll keep it in my sketchbook and I'll go back and maybe review it later or redo it or rearrange it. But yeah, I mean, because the structure of the cloth isn't that, and all the artwork, all the wall pieces that I do has got a similar structure. So I don't have to reinvent that. Because, you know, there's so many things you can do with threads. You think about the science of weaving, if you'd like, that basically it's a, you know, ones and zeros. It's back down to the basic computer language. Your thread is either up or down. And so where it goes is based on how complex your loom is and how diverse your thought process is. But yeah, so the weaving is, I mean, if you want to go into the science of weaving, you go to the Jacquard looms that actually involve the use of punch cards to move the design, the sort of pictorial imagery of the design through the weaving process. Now you've got computer assisted design, CAD/CAM systems for looms for that kind of more complex weaving structures. I don't not have a CAD/CAM system, but I do use computer design programs for weaving, sort of check myself. But anyway, so the whole thing is about this weaving. It's so varied. You do have to pull yourself in so you don't spin off into too many ideas and not able to focus.
That's, you know, so what you were describing, if we look at that idea of the loom, many people say the loom was one of the very first computers because it really does work that way. And it's funny because punch cards, before there were punch cards, which some of our listeners probably aren't going to remember, that you used to have to do a computer program via punch card.
Yep, a whole right? whole box full of punch cards.
And yeah, that was just it. To say hello on the screen.
Yep.
And
yep.
So, but it really came over from that because it was really industrializing the loom to be able to, you know, produce these things. So what you were just describing also, which I hadn't really thought about, is you have to then think when is it up, when is it down on there? And I would assume that makes a different kind of structure.
Yes. I mean, all my artwork is based on plane weave. So you have one up, one down in a structure, or you've got a twill weave where you have two up, two down in a progression. And then there are all these different patterns. So if you actually look at like brocade up, sort of these really exotic Chinese brocade fabrics, they are so complicated and so beautifully done. And on like looms that basically backstrap looms, you know, sort of your sort of least technically complicated loom, you can do complicated structures. But back to, so my weaving, as I say, it's I use a simple structure because the simple structure gives me the most sort of color option variation for me. Yeah.
I get confused, and I'm sure people do, but I get confused by some of the terms. So when you're talking about the loom, you were talking about one kind of thread goes one direction, and then we know it goes across. As kids, we used to, you know, weave in paper or.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
But yeah. What are the names? How do we describe those things, parts of the loom?
Parts of the loom. Okay, so you've got your, in any kind of loom, it could be, as you say, a cardboard loom. The strings that you put on the loom to prepare for weaving is called the warp. So you could say you're warping your loom or you're dressing your loom, you're setting it up for a project, and the weft is what you introduce into the structure, interlace into the warp threads to create a structure, a fabric. And how those weft threads are introduced into the warp will give you a pattern, a structure. So you're, you know, anyway, and then the loom itself generally One has a shuttle that you with a bobbin on it. So you wind your weft thread onto a bobbin and put it on in the shuttle, and the shuttle goes through the warp. And the warp is you step on a treadle, and the treadle will raise a group of warp threads. You've got, if you have a floor loom, you have anywhere from 2 to like 32 shafts, and those shafts have heddles on it, and each warp thread goes through a heddle on a particular shaft. And so when you step on a treadle, it raises the shaft or the group of threads, and your shuttle carrying the weft goes under those, and then you drop the shed, and then you beat back that weft thread, and then you step on another treadle, and it opens a different group of threads, and you throw your shuttle back. So your shuttle is going back and forth. You can think of sort of those industrial pictures of you know, these great looms that are clanging and banging and making huge, terrific noise. Those are actually weaving the fabric. That shuttle is being shot back and forth through the web of the warp to create the fabric.
So if I'm getting this right, and this is really, really fun, if I'm getting it right, so on the warp, you fix that. That's fixed for the entire time, right?
Correct.
So it doesn't have to all be one color, right? It could, no, you could vary that too.
Oh yeah. Well, that's what, yeah. You know, I'm, when I do drawings, I've got to figure out my vertical colors and then what my horizontal colors are going to be. And since I do a double layer fabric, it's like two layers of fabric that are interwoven. So it's like, you know, 3D tic-tac-toe. You got to think of the different layers that are going to interact and how they work.
So that stays fixed. So you put the warp on, and that is fixed.
Yep.
What isn't fixed is the two other things. So I get to change the color in my shuttle that I throw back and forth, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So I can have different shuttles with different threads.
Exactly. So lots of shuttles, lots of color. I mean, yes, you can change your weft material. You can change your fiber. You can change your color. You can change how hard you beat back the thread and make it tighter or looser.
Right.
And you can change which shafts you lift up. So you can change the pattern as it evolves.
And then that was the second part with the heddles. I was thinking on a simple loom, you're just kind of fixed usually with one or two heddles.
But
on a big one, like you're talking about,
yep,
you can have multiple ones moving up and down. And I assume that's pulling up two strings, then letting three go down or two up or one up, four down, you know, in other words, that's how that's varying. So this is incredible because you have to think ahead. It's almost like playing chess with yourself. You have to be thinking ahead, right? Which one am I using next?
Right.
To create that pattern, am I right?
Yes, and it's amazing. In the weaving studio, I have a number of people who come in and rent space and weave with me, and that our common complaint is it's hard to count to four because, you know, you get off track, you think of something else, and all of a sudden you're going from 3 to 1, and no, you're supposed to 3 to 4. So the point is that as you are counting or keeping track of your pattern, it's very much pattern recognition. So you know, to create the pattern that you want, it has to appear in a certain way. So if you're clever enough, you can look at something and know that you're going the right way. And if you're not, if you sort of get distracted, all of a sudden you forget your place and you have to sort of reassess what it is you're doing and where you're going with it. Because you can only sort of accept mistakes so often before the fabric becomes just not acceptable.
And so the thing that I think is surprising for me is the idea that You're keeping in your head all of these variables. So you've got color going in there, texture.
Well, that's where like notes, you got to have the notes. That's why you do the design. Because if you don't have a design, you got to start with a sort of an original design. You start with one idea. And the way I do it is I usually evolve the design as I go along. I might design for a piece that's say, for example, 24 inches wide by 36 inches long, but I will put on 5 yards of warp. So that'll give me all that, those other 4 yards to evolve the design in a unexpected way, you know, because I'm always trying to reinvent things as I evolve. And because it's a two-layer structure, the back of my weavings are different than the front. So sometimes I like the back better than the front.
And you flip it over.
yeah. It's like, oh my gosh, look at that. But you have to, and when you're weaving, as you're weaving, you're on the loom, you have the shuttle going back and forth and the beater is beating the fiber into place. You have maybe, like a 6 inches, 5 or 6 inches in front of you that once you've woven up that far, you have to advance the warp that's wound on the back warp beam and move the finished fabric forward so it will go wind on the cloth beam. And so you can't see what you've done. You forget what you've done. So you have to design it so that you know you're keeping track of how far you are in your design so you have control. Otherwise, I mean, if you have a design that's just the same all the way through, say you're doing a dish towel, you can just weave it and, you know, stop at the end of that particular like 36 inches and go on from there. But you do need to keep track of where you are as you go.
Yeah. And when I watch somebody like you or an accomplished weaver, you get amazed because you have this rhythm and flow.
Yeah.
And you can move it pretty quickly, which beginners can do on a simpler thing, but when they start getting complicated. It reminds me, I have a really close friend that is an organist on a pipe organ. And it reminds me a little bit of how he can have up to 5 to 10 keyboards and feet and everything moving and stops and all that stuff. And it's interesting, they're weaving a concert with notes. And
right. Well, gosh, it's very much like music.
Yeah, I was going to say, I could see the parallels when I watch you pushing pedals and doing, you know, sending that and pulling. I didn't know, and you mentioned this earlier, so beating, you have this piece of wood. Is that basically it? It sometimes it's free, but sometimes it's on a hinge, right? And you pull it back and it pushes the thread towards each other.
Right. Well, back, you know, you think of like as without all that equipment, you've got your thread that you've introduced into the web and you need to push it back into place. And basically it's like a comb, and you would have a comb or you would use a stick to push it back. And what the floor looms have, it's called a beater. Okay. And so you put a reed in the beater, and the reed is basically a comb that spreads the warp out to the desired width and has it the desired density. So whether it's like 4 threads per inch or 40 threads per inch, you have to put it through this reed, and the reed goes in the beater. And so when you throw a weft thread through the open shed, that's what it's called when the threads are open, throw it through the weft shed, the warp shed, and then you beat that thread back, and then you open a new shed, throw the shuttle through, and then beat that thread back. And so the vigor with which you bang that thread back can make for a very dense fabric or a very loose fabric. You think like a tapestry weave is very dense, and so you don't even see the warp, it's so dense. The warp is not part of the color feature. Or it can be very loose, lace-like, and where the warp is more part of the color sequence, the color theme. And yeah, so you just, that again is another way to think about cloth. Like you think about the cloth in your house, you've got curtains that are more or thin that allow a little bit of light through. And then you have your blue jeans that you're wearing that are very dense. That's a, you know, sort of functional example of fabric.
Yeah. And with yours, you said you do a tight weave. So, I mean, yeah, tight pressure with it.
Right.
And I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume if I loosen it, I'm also introducing the shadowing between that those threads more. I'm introducing more shadow, maybe, because I can go, I can see this down through the thread.
Well, it's more transparency. And so
transparency,
if you,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have a fabric that's transparent, it, you know, obviously it'll allow light through it. And in fact, my fabrics, my weavings, some of them have been hung in windows. So you can actually see sort of a little bit of light through them. They're not like blackout curtains, right. But for me, the way light reacts to my pieces is better if it's reflected off the surface instead of going through the surface.
Going through it again, yeah, because yeah, of that tightness of it.
Right.
I've been talking with my guest, Gretchen Romy Tanzer, about fine art, science, technology, weaving, how fibers can come together individually to create these magnificent works of art. And please join us for more conversation after a short break.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today I'm having a conversation with my guest, Gretchen, about how science has influenced her work, how science influences and math influences weaving. And let's talk a little bit about, back on the thing of color. So you mentioned something that just seemed like it's just common to you, but it's not something I think of. You said you had a wall of color, is that right?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, the... you think about a box of colored pencils, you have like, I don't know, 72 colored pencils.
Right.
Got to get the big box, not just 12. the fiber that I use, I like using cotton mainly because it's got a really wide range of colors. It's stable, you know, it works for me. And so the company I order from, might be as many as like 75 colors. And so wow, to have all those different ranges, and that may mean that you've got like five browns that are really sort of a nice gradation, tonal gradation, or you may have a good batch like grays from black to white in achromatic values. You've got like hot pink, you've got dusty pink, you know, so all those colors, even the colors you would think that I don't use that much, like the hot pink or the, like the, like shocking orange. But those colors are so useful as like a little bit of highlight. I often in my weaving will accentuate a space by having maybe two threads of something that is a contrast to what it's next to. Like maybe I'm weaving green, I'll have two picks of red. And then that, it doesn't shout red, but it's like, ooh, there's a little active surface there. Because, you know, having taught color theory for a while, you know that if you have complementary colors, in other words, ones that are opposite each other on the color wheel, they fight. Like yellow and purple, or orange and green. They just don't look good together. I mean, but they do if you have them in the right amount, like a garden, a green garden with an orange flower in it. It's that orange flower really commands your attention because there's very little of it in a field of green. So that's like how you use color. And so I just am always, not just when I start a new fiber, say if I want to try weaving with silk, I've got to get all the colors. You know, even though I might not use them all right away, someone will use those colors. That's one of the great things about having this weaving studio, because, you know, I can get all this, have this yarn for everybody to use, not just me, but it's there as inspiration as well as, you know, to use in your projects.
Yeah, so I assume you have some sort of organization to that wall in terms of what you
put
together, right?
Well, if I look or turn around in my studio, I've got them based on color groupings. Like I'll have, I've got my orange and reds on one shelf. I've got my purples and browns and then on one shelf, and then greens on one shelf and blues on a shelf. And then all my achromatics, my whites and blacks and grays on another shelf.
Yeah, and that's not unlike, you know, I'm with you. When I was a kid, I could hardly wait to go back to school because I get my fresh box of Crayola crayons.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, and I wanted that 64 box then.
With a little sharpener.
Yeah, with a little sharpener. And, you know, but color pencils are the same way. I always try to keep them, and markers the same way. I try to keep them within some sort of spectrum or range so that I have got those together. That really brings up an interesting thing. So we know that our eyes, and maybe it's because we know the reds and that area have more energy in the wavelength. I wonder if we are also then drawn by our eye to that higher energy. So what you're talking about is if I introduce that orange flower, it's going to pop off of that green because my eye is drawn to that higher energy wavelength there.
Well, yeah, I mean, there again, I was fortunate enough to be a teacher, so I could sort of continue to, you know, do professional development in sort of those more theoretical color and design and optics and all that stuff, photography, everything sort of based on that. So that to know what your brain or your eyes do to color, like, you know, okay, so I'm going to have a dark background. That means it's going to recede. And if I put something bright on it, it's going to, that white or that lighter value, like yellow is always a lighter, even if you do a saturated yellow, it's higher on the spectrum level than say blue or red that's in a saturated version. Yeah, it's so interesting, just amazing.
It's really amazing because you also can be thinking about, you could say, well, I want my weaving to simulate looking like cubes, kind of an isomorphic cubes turned on their side a little bit.
Yep.
And you have to be concerned about where that lighter thread goes so that that edge of that cube looks like it would be. The highlight would be wherever the light source is, the highlight would be there. So you're trying to create that same thing with threads.
Yeah, for sure. We're like where the shadows are going to be. If you want that cube, if you want to continue that idea, that if you want it to be inset, you know, your shadow is going to be on the top of it. If you want it to be outset, you have the shadow underneath it. And the shadow, you know, in like a, if I'm setting up a cube, because all my weavings are flat, there's no texture. So it's all visual. The visual illusion of dimension. So that little highlight, like two little threads of a darker value at the bottom of a block will give you that weight, the solidity of it, and give you that depth illusion. Or like the higher lights on the top will do that also. So like in a cube, so if you do a highlight on down the right side and across the bottom side, you'll get a different effect than if you have it on the top and on the left. So yeah, it's It just playing with it. It real super simple. I mean, it's not that complicated, but it really kind of sets up this visual illusion, which is nice.
Yeah, and you, when you're talking about your thread, I guess I was surprised when I was in the shop, particularly the thread that you use. It's actually quite thin. I mean, it's not, it wouldn't even be on the scale of what some people knit with.
No.
It's much smaller, but it's not like thread that I put my sewing machine. So it's,
well, I've done a sewing machine before. So like that thin enough. And that just, I mean, it's beautiful, but it just takes too long. You know, I have a limit.
I was going to say, you're doing a lot more passing back and forth.
Yeah.
That little thread.
Yeah, exactly. But the thicker the thread, the less blending you get.
Oh.
So if you have a finer thread, it blends more effectively.
So if I want to make something recede and I want to make it though transition out like it's getting lighter, you're right. I use a range of colors getting there. Right. So I might go from dark to light or dark light to dark within the same palette as much as I have.
Right. Yeah.
Again, you have your limitations in that you can't get that many colors. I mean, 72 is wonderful, but but it's hard even within the reds to have too many reds.
You don't use all those colors, but the point is to make those gradations. In fact, recently I finished a piece that I had an unexpected but pleasing blend where I went from like a coral pink into a blue, and that, I mean, those are contrasting values, so contrasting colors. But if you do a gradation, it's almost like a Fibonacci change where you go from one color to the next. You don't just chop it off and start another one, because then you get a hard change. If you want to do a gradual change, you might introduce one thread of the what you're changing into, do a little more of what you're in, maybe two threads of what you're changing into. So you do a gradual transition from one color to the next, to get that gradual transition.
Yeah, and I assume that when you put like a yellow next to a green, but you don't put a lot of yellow next to it, then you do get a blending effect. It's like
you do.
With paint, right? So you're starting to get a yellow green.
Yeah. In fact, you know what, you know, when I buy yarn, if, you know, when you're dyeing, when the dyers dye the fiber, they have a particular recipe, and they use the same sort of recipe for every time they make that color, but every different dye lot, you get a different color, different slight change. I mean, it might be yellow, but that yellow is slightly different. So if you have I've tried to pay attention to, if I have run out of a particular color I'm trying to use, and then I'm going to use a new cone or skein of yarn. Supposed to be the same, but it's not. So you have to do a transitional change so you don't have this obvious, oops, I just had to change dye lots and make it obvious. So that's, you know, you always have to think of that stuff. And it's always a shame when you run out of a color that you're using and you weren't paying attention.
That isn't very far from what people that just sew clothes together and stuff, if they're buying the fabric, they have to be careful which lot. They don't want to try to mix those two. They say they're the same color, but they may not be.
It's even true
in the paint store. They're not exactly the same unless.
The whole thing of color mixing in the paint department, oh my gosh, that's a really great place to get color samples. If you ever want to play with color, go to a paint store and get the little paint swatches, and it's like the best.
I hadn't thought about that. And then you could lay your, then you can lay your threads along that and get as close a match as you want.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. When I'm working with the customer, we need physical color to refer to, because, you know, screens, we all have different color values on our screens, that they're calibrated differently, or your printer's calibrated differently. You need an actual physical paint chip or piece of fabric, or, you know, have the customer come in and pick the colors out so they see what I have instead of going by what's on their screen.
Right. And you have enough, what's wonderful, and I bought some of those when I was there, but you have enough like little samples of where you mix different colors together. So that's also helpful, I would think, in at somebody helping, helping you to compose a larger work.
Right. Yeah. Those little samples are just, they're a hoot to make, because they're easy and they're quite appealing little things.
Yeah.
Use them as coasters or whatever. In fact, one could take a group of those and frame them to make a piece. That's that's a future idea. So, and I'm thinking, oh gosh,
I like that idea. You know, I can see it being, you know, how people will get and even purchase simply, you know, a frame from somewhere that already has a mat cut to those, and you could put them in there just like you would have pictures. And I think that'd be lovely. Well, again, then you would have to get into choosing the mat color and the frame color. And
there just isn't enough time in the world to do all the things you want. And that's sort of one of the, I feel fortunate that the type of weaving I do, I've not really exhausted the potential, because every time something comes along, maybe a weaver asks a question about, what about this? And it'll take me off in a different tangent. Recently, a year ago, I was preparing for a workshop for the Weavers Guild of Boston, and was on complex double weave. And oh my goodness, I went off in a total, like a wormhole of exploration that I have just barely scratched the surface, that has to do with transitional changes in blocks. And it's a whole different sort of a geeking out in weaving structures.
That's so great, Gretchen. I love this, the way you're thinking about it and what drives an artist. And it's that there's always more potential, and there's stuff in there. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others any of the ideas that we're exploring in today's show, and we'll be right back.
This is Dave Bagdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm having a conversation with our guest, Gretchen Tanzer, about the different types of looms, color theory, threads, and its use in fine arts. So I want to also talk a little bit, because you got us going right before the break, this idea of having the reward when you're an artist, or any creative, but particularly an artist, this reward of that there's just many more things. In other words, ideas just keep spawning themselves.
I think one thing that kind of is good about the crafts and obviously the weaving is that, you can, your piece of fabric can always be functional, you know, so you're making stuff for the wall, but then, you know, you run out of wall space, so you got to make stuff for the table, for your kitchen, for your, you know, clothing. And so all and I continue to teach weaving. And so I always am inspired by my students. And I think that's like anybody who's ever been a veteran teacher gets as much out of their students as they do out of their own work, you know, because it's that complication, that the question that a student asks, what if I blah, 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 or can I do this, or they have a catastrophic error. How can we fix it? And so that's, keeps your brain, coming up with new ways of dealing with all of that.
Yeah. And, as a teacher myself, I feel that same thing that you're feeling, Gretchen. And that is that and you have to be the right kind of teacher, it leaves yourself open to being open to that. There's different.
Oh, that's true. You have to,
right?
You have to be fallible.
And so what I find is I learn as much from them about what they're doing that I might not have ever thought of that way, that using color that way or using, it's a technique that they're using. And yeah. You have to be careful about saying, oh, no, that's not the right technique as well.
Oh, no. Because... In my weaving studio, if do whatever, correcting mistakes, that's up to the individual who's weaving it if they really want to correct the mistake.
Or they think it's a mistake. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you can just do it again and call it a design feature. We're all about how to make maximize your time and sort of embrace the errors. But, I have recall a woman who came to my studio a few years ago, and she took a class with me, and she actually only stayed for half of a day because she felt that I wasn't able to answer her question. But boy, oh boy, the question she asked me got me off on this great path. I'm sorry I wasn't able to help this, person out. But I think that kind of thing is, if you can just get over it and realize that you're not going to be able to help everybody out, and go with the idea that this person is trying to figure out what this person is asking and go with that. Anyway, it's just I'm grateful for this person to come through, and I'm sorry I wasn't able to help them.
Yeah, but that's okay. I think that what you're talking about as well is really an overlap for artists and scientists. And one of those is that the mistakes are the things that we learn the most from.
Yeah.
We think of, scientists and they get there and there's a finished product, or we think of artists who, they keep producing things, but often it's all the mistakes that are in there. That sometimes those mistakes become the things that are no longer mistakes that you want to repeat in something else.
Well, yeah, in the weaving studio, we always, I'm a big fan of samples. So you've got to, if you're doing something new or different or anything like using a different fiber, you weave a sample, you do a sketch. I mean, that means you have to wind your warp and set your loom up. And a sample is not like a sketch, but you still have to set the loom up. So you have to be willing to do that kind of more technical work. And then you try different colors, you try different fibers, you try things that you wouldn't normally do, like go outside the box, weave with something that you really are sure you're not going to use, but try it anyway, because you just don't know what's going to happen. Then you cut it off, and then you have to wash it. So 85% of the stuff that we weave is washed. And it's not finished until it's wet finished. You can think of a wool rug. You're not going to wash that. You're not going to wash a lace curtain, because the lace aspect of it would
deteriorate in the.
Yeah, it would deteriorate. So, but all the work that I do is not done until it's washed. And I have to, wash it in hot water with soap and mush it around and then dry it. And then it becomes what it's supposed to be.
You have to stretch it a little bit after you wash it, after it's been wet.
Or I iron it.
Iron it.
Yeah.
Because it needs to just, because
flatten it out. Yeah.
Like all things. And I would assume that the person that does your yarn is pretty good about those dyes not being.
Well, there's
or,
that.
Or what if, happens.
Oh my gosh. It can be a nightmare. There's this washing product, it's called Synthrapol. It's a industrial washing chemical, and that does a pretty good job of taking out any sort of fugitive dye. But if you're going to weave something that you're using red right next to white, red is notorious for bleeding out. You have to test your fiber before you use it. If you're
going to say, wash that fiber and see.
Yeah, put it, you know, what I do is I take a little, you know, a little white porcelain cup, put hot water in it, a little dab of soap and the fiber, a little coil of the fiber in it. If the water turns pink right away, I just ditch it. I don't use it.
No, you couldn't because
I write. I write on the cone that it's a bleeder. So, you know, somebody could use it. No, seriously, somebody could use it if they're doing something that's all that color.
Yeah, sure.
But no, and red,
oh my gosh.
Sometimes blue. But yeah, it's, it can be a real problem. Like when I put the water that I use, it turns bright red. And then I have to wash it until the water runs clear.
Okay.
Yeah, so that
you're continuing to get that away, right, that dye away from there.
Just have to.
Because no matter how color fast we have something.
Yeah, and actually the recent piece, I washed it and then I came back, you know, I let it hang dry. I could see that the red had migrated out into where I didn't want it, so I had to wash it again. And then it got rid of the situation.
And it got rid of it.
Yeah.
Would you do me a favor, and for our listeners, where can they see your work online? So
my website is tanzersfiberworks.com. That's TANZERS fiberworks.com.
Great. And of course, if they were to come out to Cape Cod, they could visit you in Brewster.
Yep. My weaving studio, it's Tanzer Weaving Studio and Gallery. 2623 Main Street, Brewster, Massachusetts.
That's wonderful. Because I know that some of our listeners will want to see these incredible pieces. One quick question that I had that I just forgot about was when we were talking about the warp and we were talking about what we were doing back and forth with the, you know, vertical threads and then we had the horizontal threads.
The weft,
The weft. That can I vary texture and also thread size?
Oh yes, that gives you a whole different thing. If you introduce like a thick thread, you definitely can do that.
Wow.
I mean, you can put grass in there. You can put wire. You can use paper. You know, so like weaving with raffia, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the other is when you think about it. And weaving it together, can you stitch together different things that you've woven? Is there a way to do that?
Yeah, well, I do that. I mean, if you have a loom that's like, say, 36 inches wide, and you want a piece of like a tablecloth that's 45 inches wide, you can weave two pieces and sew them together, or you can actually weave a piece of fabric that folds out like that is very cool.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, you can leave that. But no, you're sewing things together. I mean, you think about the indigenous textiles of South America.
Right.
Their looms were, you know, maybe 12 inches wide, and the fabrics, the ponchos, are made of strips of fabric sewn together.
That's just wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for this conversation, Gretchen.
Thank you. I hope I've hooked a few people into wanting to know more about weaving.
I'm sure you have. And I would say seek out your website, but also a lot of museums still have times when there are weavers, some of the history museums and things. It's just worth going and watching them through their process. You'll pick up on it. I want to thank you so much. And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.